That, should I wait 1 minute or better to wait 1 minute? Okay, so I'll start 5 minutes later today. Thank you. Okay, so let me start. I just want to summarize what we did so far. And as usual, I will not erase this blackboard, so you can always copy it at the end. So we are in the process of computing perhaps the most obvious and most natural quantity in a conformal field theory, namely the quantum dimensions, the correct dimensions of the gauge invariant operators, of the good operators which have good anomalous dimensions. So this set of numbers is our goal, and they govern the two-point functions, the behavior of two-point functions of our conformal field theory. How do we go about computing them? If the coupling is very large, we can use ADS-CFT, and we know that each operator is dual to a string, such as the one I drew there, where I, for example, I represented a string that is point-like in ADS and non-trivial in S5. And we have to compute the energies of those strings. For example, we identify the state that should be dual to a state with only Z's and X's, so the ones that we are studying. And this was the circular string. We called it the single mode solution, and this was the energy we found two or three lectures ago. But what about weak coupling? Well, weak coupling, what we do is we do perturbative computations. We are at weak coupling, we do Feynman diagrams. Now, luckily, life is much nicer than doing Feynman diagrams. Feynman diagrams was the very beginning. We did all these one-loop Feynman diagrams, and we saw that we could map the problem of computing these four-dimensional observables to the problem of diagonalizing and finding the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of a one-dimensional spin chain. Now, per se, this is not really, we cannot claim victory yet, because this is still not a trivial problem. It's still a 2 to the L by 2 to the L matrix. In principle, this is still a very hard problem. But then there is this very nice description using integrability, which tells us that if we now think of these operators in this spin chain, remember that we identify spin up as being one of the scalars of the theory, call it Z, and spin down the other one, X. And if we have a state with many of these particles, and we give them momenta P1, P2, and so on, then the energy, the dimension associated to this operator, the energy of the spin chain, is just the sum of the individual energies of each of the magnets, where the magnets are quantized according to Beta equations, which is just a statement that if I take one particle, particle J, and I carry it around the ring, when I carry it around the ring, it scatters with everyone else. This is this product K not equal to J. And whenever it scatters by one of its friends, it gets a phase, and the total phase shift from each of the other particles plus the free propagation phase shift must be trivial, so it must be a multiple of 2 pi, and the total e to the I phase should be equal to 1. The wave function should be periodic. So you see that an operator in n equals 4 super young Mills is now uniquely determined by a set of p's that obeys this equation. So if you give me, say, if I want a state with 5 magnets, and here are the 5 momenta that are quantized according to Beta equation, you give me 5 numbers. This parameterizes uniquely the state. Then I know how to reconstruct it following the Beta ansatz that we saw yesterday. We just plug them into the Beta wave function. That's the state, and the anomalous dimension is this. There were some very useful variables if you remember, which is basically you denote this quantity, you change from pj to this u. And this quantity is nice because you see that if you denote e to the ip by u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2, we saw that the S matrix that we found becomes just a very simple algebraic function. So all you have to do is solve these algebraic functions. So you can multiply the denominator here. So you have some set of polynomial equations of n variables. Find the zeros of these polynomial equations. And each set of solutions, each set of beta roots, they are called, gives you one state. So each state is parameterized by the different solutions to this equation. And the energy, the sine square in these variables becomes this 1 over u squared plus 1 part. Plus the cyclicity of the trace that we are going to discuss shortly, which I briefly mentioned at the end of the last time. Okay. So where's my glass of water? Yeah. Okay. Let me emphasize again that this kind of solution here that we saw yesterday describes the Heisenberg spin chain with periodic boundary conditions. But then there is this trace, this cyclicity, that will select some of the states. But for now, as usual, let's just impose that the system is closed, and we will impose the trace in 5 minutes. Okay. So now, we want to study the space of solutions to these equations. Now you see that there are several solutions. So what could be a good way to parameterize the different solutions, to characterize the different solutions to this equation? So imagine that there is no interaction. Imagine the equation is just e to the I p l equal to 1. How do we parameterize the solutions to this equation? What are the different solutions to this equation? E to the I p l equal to 1. There are the roots of 1. So what do you write? You write p equal 2 pi k over l. So something very useful is to keep in mind that this 1 is e to the 2 pi k, or let's call it n, I prefer n, I. Okay? You see that if there is no interaction, if I say that this quantity here is given by this integer, it can be any of the roots of unity. So the way we can do it, when we have, for example, e to the I p l equal 1, what do? We take the log and we write that I p l equal to the log of 1, which is 2 pi n times I. There are several branches of the log that I can choose. So we conclude that p is equal to 2 pi n over l. Okay, so it's a more complicated way of explaining something trivial. But now, we do the same with our bit equations. We take the log, and by taking the log of bit equations, what do we get? We get I bj times l plus a sum over k not equal to j of log of S matrix of pk pj, this is the log of the left-hand side, is equal to 2 pi nji for each j, j equal 1 up to n. So for each particle, I choose an integer. For each of the magnons, I choose an integer. So you can imagine the magnons are all free. Then for each magnon, I just quantize. Each magnon p is 2 pi n over l. And then you can think that you turn on the interaction. And that will give rise to this equation. Now, okay, let's cancel out the I. Let's put 1 over I here. And here 2 pi n. Now the claim is that these equations here, for each choice of a set of nj's, that is a set n1, n2, I choose an integer for each of the magnons. This is what we call mod number. For each choice, the solution of these equations is unique. So to parameterize all solutions of this equation, what you have to give me, if you have five magnons, you have to give me five integers. Okay? You can think, if the magnons were free, you would just tell which mode each magnon is. And this is a generalization of the mode when you put an interaction.
So the integers themselves have to be between 1 and capital N?
Or sorry?
Are the integers nj arbitrary, or do they have to be smaller than capital N?
Okay, what about this in this end, you mean?
Yes.
So if you choose a branch for, if you say that this p lives between minus pi and pi, say in the Brillouin zone, and this S matrix, log of this S matrix, if you plot it, it also goes between minus pi and pi. So then the left-hand side with this choice of branches, which you can choose, oscillates between, say, L plus N and minus L minus N. So there is a range of n's that you can choose, otherwise you'll find no solution. But okay, let's take L to be large, n to be large, and then you take any random n's, like 1, 2, 5, 7, and so on, and you get one solution. Okay? Very good. So they are exactly the analog of the mode numbers. So an operator in n equals 4, a good operator in n equals 4 super Young Mills, that is an operator with definite anomalous dimension and so on, is in one-to-one correspondence to this set of integers n1 up to nn. So if you give me these sets of integers and also give me, say, the length of the chain, then with this data, with this just this set of integers, I solve this equation. These are the mode numbers of my particles. I compute their momenta, and I plug them into the formula for the energy, and I find a solution.
Question?
Yes.
What's a good operator?
Good operator is an operator with definite anomalous dimension. It's an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian. And by good, we mean eigenvector of the dilatation operator. An operator with definite anomalous dimension. Okay, so we simplify dramatically our problem. Now, all we have to do is compute, is solve this equation. But I will give you shortly an argument that makes it very clear, or at least very reasonable, that the solution, once you specify some sets of n, the solution is unique. Of course, if you have no S matrix, it's obvious, right? I mean, P is equal to n. When you turn on the S matrix, by continuity, it should still be the case, but there is actually a more or less rigorous argument that we can give to show that there are no subtleties with this. But before, I would just like to show you that this cyclicity constraint that right now looks a bit mysterious, it looks like we will have to solve these equations and then check if it's okay or not, it's trivial to implement and just is a simple condition on what kind of integers I should choose. Okay? Because you see that what happens is now from this equation here, if I consider the sum over j of this equation, what do we get? We get that the sum that of pj times L is equal to the sum of 2 pi nj. The S matrices just cancel. They are anti-symmetric. They just cancel when I sum over everyone. And I just get, what is this equation telling me? This is telling me that, if you see, this equation is telling me that the total momenta times length is equal to 2 pi times an integer. Sum of nj's is another integer. So this is true in any physical system that I put in a box, right? If I put this eraser in a box, the momentum of this eraser times length is equal to 1. The interactions between the molecules are absolutely irrelevant. By action-reaction, they just all cancel out. That's the analog of that. The S matrix is just cancel out, and I just get a total momentum of my system times length, exponential of that, would be equal to 1. But we want more. We want that the total momenta, not the total momenta times L, we want the total momenta to be equal to 1. So this is what follows from periodicity. From cyclicity, you have to impose something further. From cyclicity, you want to impose, remember, that the sum of pj from j equal to 1 up to n is equal to an integer, 2 pi m. Remember, this was following from the condition that you need e to the I total momenta equal to 1. Remember, when you shift all n's by 1. So you see what you need to do. So it's very simple. So we simply take a set of n's, nj's, making sure that the sum of nj divided by L is still an integer. So not only the sum of n's is an integer, but if you divide by L, it must still be an integer. Okay? For example, say minus n2 minus n1, n1, n2. For example, if you choose these mod numbers, which are symmetric, the sum of them is 0, it's perfectly fine. Okay? So you see that selecting out the states that are cyclic is a triviality. You just choose the sum of mod numbers to be a multiple of L, typically 0. Okay? Okay, very good. So let's maybe solve some example of this bit equation. Let's take, for example, the mode numbers nj. Let's take two particles and take the mode numbers to be minus n and n. Okay? Minus n and n. So in particular, this will imply minus n and n. This will imply, if you think for a bit actually, that the pj's are equal to two particles with minus p and p. I just choose opposite mode numbers, you get opposite momenta. Minus p and p. And it's easy to see that the S matrix between, let me see which normalization I use, between, let this be p, then this is minus p. Between minus p and p is equal to, I put there, then I put minus p, is equal to e to the minus ip. Okay? And therefore, the bit and Zatz equations are just telling you that e to the ipl times the S matrix e to the minus ip is equal to 1. So in this case, the solutions, again, this one is e to the 2 pi n times I. This is our choice of mode number. So p is just 2 pi n over L minus 1. So this is one example. Two particles with opposite momenta. Their momenta is quantized, and it's given by 2 pi n over L minus 1. Now, for more particles, like 3 particles, 4 particles, and so on, it's very hard to solve these equations over there, up there, without say, a computer or something. If you have a polynomial, if you are solving this equation with 10 variables or something, then you are in trouble in trying to solve them analytically. So could you imagine that there might be some limit where we might make analytic progress? So there are two obvious limits that we can do. Small number of particles, right? If the number of particles is not very big, then we might still hope to be able to have some luck and to still solve those polynomial equations, right? Yeah, polynomial equation of cubic degree, it's still okay. Quartic degree, it's still okay. Order 6, it becomes a bit of a pain. What's the other extreme limit where maybe we could try to play with?
Thermodynamic
limit. So we could try now to play. Let's try to explore the classical limit. And this is not just because this is a limit where we can. This is what we should do if we want to have any connection with classical strings. Classical strings will be dual, of course, to operators with very large charges. That's why they are classical. So J1 and J2, right there, were very large. These are macroscopic charges. So these are not operators with one or two magnets. They're huge operators with a huge number of particles. So if we want to have any hope of matching with string theory in this classical limit, if we want to be describing the same kind of objects with the same kind of charges and so on, this is the natural thing to do, is to study very large spin chains with many operators so that they have very large angular momenta, very large charges. So we want to study a limit which is a classical limit where the spins behave, where the spin chain will behave classically or semi-classically. So a way of obtaining such a limit where the spin chain, which is this discrete object, becomes continuous is to consider configurations of spins where the spins are changing slowly along the chain and describe some sort of spin wave along the chain. Okay? Then this spin, if you have many, many spins and you have some classical spin wave, will be described by some classical field theory. So the picture that we want to explore is to consider a limit where we have our spins and we imagine them changing slowly along the chain. And this is the kind of state we are interested in studying. Where by slowly, what do I mean? I mean that to see some significant distance, some significant difference, I must go to distances of the order of the length of the chain. The chain is locally always ferromagnetic and it's changing slowly. Yeah.
And how do we go from an IC model to a model that can have continuity?
The model was not Heising model, it was an SU2 model.
Yeah, okay, but the point is that we could fully have a spin up or spin down.
Right. But you know that up plus down is left.
Oh.
So a base is spin up and down, but it's SU2. I mean, we can make spin X, spin Y, spin whatever. Okay, very good. So this is the picture where we have some wavelength of our excitations that is of order L. This is what we want to aim at, okay? And then we want to think that we will have some sort, there should be some sort of classical field N that changes along the chain where this sigma would be something like 2 pi j over the lattice number. Okay? So this is the kind of picture that we have in mind. We want to have some field that varies slowly along the chain where these vectors are pointing in any direction, in any of the three directions. Okay? So what does it mean? If the wavelength is of order L, what does it mean about, what does it tell us about the moment of the excitations? Wavelength is of order L, momentum is of order? Momentum is of order 1 over L. So this means we want to consider particles of order 1 over L. We want to take the length to infinity, and we want to have a fixed density. So this is the limit we are interested in. Momentum guys will go like 1 over L. L is very large, and there are many spins. Okay? And of course, again, let me emphasize again the motivation. We know that a single trace operator is somehow dual to a string. This we saw several times. And of course, a string, a classical string, must correspond to what is called a large single trace operator. If you have a very small operator, it's more like a quantum string, that is like a low excited state of the string and not a big classical string. Okay? Now, this picture is quite nice because you see what happens when you have a vector n that changes slowly along the chain and it points in one of three directions. So what happens is that if this picture is correct, then you can imagine a sphere and you have a vector n, and the vector n, as you go along the chain, this vector n will point in different directions and it will draw a string. Right? And then you could ask, is this our string? And the answer is yes. And we will see it.
Question.
Yes?
What did you mean by large string principle?
I mean this. The length is very I mean this. Yeah? It's this classical object which is very large and behaves classically. Okay, this is a physical picture. Let's work with it. Now let's go to these equations here. And let's hope that given that this is such a nice and physical limit, there should be some nice simplification that should be allow us to make progress with. So what does simplify when we do that? So what does P being very large means in terms of U? So let's first take the log of bit equations. We get L over I log of uj plus I over 2 uj minus, I'm just taking the log. In the meantime, think about how should u scale if p is of order l, or 1 over l. P is of order 1 over l, so uj is of order what? Think about this while I write. Plus sum k not equal to j up to n 1 over I log uj minus uk minus I, uj minus uk plus I is equal to 2 pi nj. Okay. So what's the answer? What is p? What is u? U is of order what?
1 over n.
U is of order 1 over l? No.
Over
l. So remember that we have u plus I over 2 over u minus I over 2 equal to e to the ip. So if you want this to be very close to 1, you want u to be very large. You want u to be of order l. Alternatively, the inverse of this is u equal 1 half cotangent of p over 2, as we saw yesterday. So if p is very small, u is 1 over p. So we want u to be of order l. So what do you propose to do if you use of order L, which is very large? Sorry? Yeah, expand, right? U is very large, let's expand. So then this term here, for example, becomes what? Becomes just L over UJ. Right? If you factor out uj, it becomes 1 over uj, 1 over uj, it gets just l over uj, which is of order 1, you see? L and uj, they are both of order l, so this is what it is. What about this one? Minus 2 sum over k not equal to j, 1 over uj minus uk. Is equal to 2 pi nj. Do you recognize these equations? Yes? Or something similar? You remember we saw exactly these equations with u's replaced by lambdas in matrix model. Not exactly this. There was one. What was the difference? What was the difference? I listed in the wiki. Did someone check the wiki yesterday? There were 3 points in the wiki, yes.
It was the inverse of u, L over uj was like the inverse of
Right. So it was a linear force that came from an harmonic oscillator potential. And now it's 1 over u. So the potential is a bit different. And there was no integer. So it was without this, and here it was uj. So it was a linear potential that was confining. The particles wanted to go to the center. And then they repelled each other, and therefore they opened a bit. And they formed the smooth distribution. OK, so now let's see what's the physics of this. Now again, let's use our intuition to see where the particles will go. So again, we use the electrostatic picture. So we think of the UJs as positions of charged particles. And they have some interaction, which is the sum, and they have some potential. Okay? Now it turns out that here the dynamics is quite funny. It's a bit more interesting than in the matrix model case. So let's see what happens. So we have our L over U, so, and we have our minus 2 pi nj, and here L over uj. Okay? So ignoring the S matrix, a particle feels a force into that direction from this guy, and feels a force from that direction from this guy here. You see that what I'm representing here is the potential. This is the force. This is the force. But what I'm representing here, of course, is the potential. Okay.
Why is the constant force? Okay.
So the force is positive, L over u. If u is positive, the force points that. Yeah. Here the force is negative. So we have a particle that feels a constant force, which is the integer, to go to the left, and feels a decaying force to go to the right. So the particle will want to go here, or to the equilibrium of this potential, where this position is just, the solution of that equation is just L over 2 pi nj, just the equilibrium condition if you ignore the S matrix, right? If you ignore the S matrix, the particle, I mean, it is just, yes, it's clear. You just ignore the interaction, and L over U is equal to 2 pi n. So U is equal to L over 2 pi n. But now, if we have several particles, they have this interaction. So what do you think will happen? You could think it will be the same as before. They will repel, and therefore a distribution will open, and they will go to some cut here. Right? This will be the same as before. Remember? So they go to a point, but then if there are two particles, they would repel, and therefore it would open a cut. Okay? This is wrong, but do you agree that this is what this is the analogy to what we saw before? So this is a bit, this is, as it is, it's wrong, and let's analyze this a bit more carefully, because we'll see the force is attractive instead of repulsive. So let's see what happens. If you have this uj, and now you put a uk, so this is uj, and this is uk. So uj is bigger than uk, so this force is negative. You see? There's a minus sign. So actually, this particle here feels an attraction to the other particle, and this one feels an attraction to this. So it's not true. There's no repulsion. There is attraction between the particles. But okay, we are being very narrow-minded. Why are we just exploring the real axis? There is a full complex plane to explore. So let's think about the complex plane. So we have this force, minus 2 over delta x. And what is the flow lines of this force when you have delta x? So if delta x is positive, if delta x is positive, we saw the force is attractive, so it points in this direction. If delta x is negative, the force is positive, so it points in this direction. But if you see that if delta x is 1 over I, suppose delta x is I, then you get minus 2 over I, which is 2i. So if the particles are here, the lines are like this. Do you agree? So this 1 over x, it attracts in this direction and repels in this one. So what will happen is that the particles, they will go here and then spread out in the orthogonal direction of the plane. So what will happen is that we will have the complex plane, U. There will be a point here which is L. This point will be L over 2 pi n. Okay? But what happens is that the particles that have the same n, they want to go all here, but then they repel and they start opening some contours that move into the complex plane. Okay? Why it's not vertical? Because as it goes more and more up, for that you have to work out the lines, what happens when they go up, because they go up, but then the potential here, the force of repulsion is not as big acting here than it is acting here, because this point is further apart. Right? So then this, the origin, the potential doesn't repel this point as much, so that point bends a bit towards the origin. Okay? So these points, they are characterized, they have all these points have the same nj. If you give them the same nj, they want to go to the same minima of the potential, and then they spread out in the complex direction. Right?
Yes. Why did we need to go to the complex delta x?
Because of this picture here. Because what happens if you put the particles that they repel in this direction? So you put them together, they clump and open up.
I mean, why didn't we just consider that the particle would be on the real axis?
I'm just telling you that that would not be a solution of the equation. Okay, let me finish explaining what is the final configuration, then we can come back to that. So do you agree that all particles here, they all have the same integer nj? What happens if I choose another integer nj? If I choose another integer nj, 2 pi over n would be somewhere here. And then I can put some other particles with another set of integers nj. So all these particles, they have another nj. Okay? And I could put them also, if this is the origin, I could also put them on this side here. Okay? So this would be some example where I could have, for example, something like this for the mode numbers. The nj's could be equal to minus 2, minus 2, minus 2, minus 2, many times, minus 2. And this would be this guy here. Then 3, 3, 3, 3, many times, this would be this guy's here. And then, for example, 1, 1, 1, 1 many times, and this would be this guy here. Okay. You see that if the integer is bigger, the force is bigger, it goes more close to the origin. L over 2 pi n is small. Okay? So is this picture clear? Now you see, this is what I mean, why this electrostatic picture is so powerful. Now imagine guessing what the solutions of these equations would be without this intuition of putting particles and forces and so on. How could you have guessed that you have these nice shapes in the complex plane without this picture? But again, to come back to your question. So you agree that this equation, I can think of it as an electrostatic equilibrium condition for some particles that can take complex values. And you know that if the forces repel in the complex direction, put them anywhere in the complex plane. Now put some dynamics that they will evolve and go to the minimum of the potential until they become in equilibrium. Then, because the forces repel, these distances here would open. Okay?
I was asking this question because the momenta, uh-huh, is some real number, at least some real number.
No, momentum doesn't need to be real. That's a good point. Very good. Okay, excellent question. Excellent comment. So this guy here is an unreal momentum. This one. But there are always complex conjugate pairs, so the total momentum is real, but the individual momentum is complex. But this is totally intuitive. What does it mean? It means that you have a bunch of particles that have a center of mass momentum which is real, but among themselves they have some small imaginary parts. But that means they form a bound state. When you have imaginary parts or momenta, it means that the wave functions decay when they become separate. So what happens is that this will describe some lumps of the string that will be coherent and that will move in a coherent way. So this would be a solution where you will have like three coherent bumps. Okay? Okay, very good. So now we see what happens in the classical limit. In the classical limit, what happens is that in the U plane, now instead of many points, you will have some contours C. C1, C2, C3. The points will become more and more, and they will become some dense lines in the complex plane. Each line with its own integer. This one parameterized by n1, this one by n2, this one by n3. Okay? So you have this nice description that you parameterize the states. So the parameterization is given, and let's suppose there are n minus 2 of these guys, n3 of these guys, and n1 of these guys. Okay? Then each cut is parameterized by what is n and how many particles are there. But this is infinite, so rather capital N1 over the length. And here capital N2 over the length and N2. And here capital N3 over the length and N3. Each of them is parameterized by a mode number n and the number of particles for that mode number over R. Okay? And now you see what this looks like. This, as I said, the way to think about this, the number to think about these solutions that have a certain number of cuts. You should think that the number of cuts is like how many modes are you exciting? How many Fourier modes of this field N are you exciting? So this picture would correspond, for example, to 3 modes of N being excited with amplitudes n over L and mode number or frequencies, it's the same, n. Now, it's not strictly speaking Fourier modes because the field theory that will describe this n, like the field theory that describes the strings, is strongly coupled and it's not a linear theory that I just decompose in modes. But they are the analog of the Fourier modes. So having a solution with many cuts will, of course, correspond to a very complicated solution with many modes. And the size of the cuts, intuitively, is related to the amplitude of that mode. Right? So you take a solution that only has one big cut, it's one mode, plus some very small cut. Okay, it's one mode plus a small excitation. Yes.
We need like infinite number of modes to make our classical solution to the string.
Very good. So now let's try to guess what could be what could be our circular string, for example. Yes.
It wasn't the Boolean at with doubling at one loop.
Yes.
So how can we relate it with a string?
Yeah, so by string, I mean the state that is dual to that one. Of course, that one is the state described at strong coupling. Now it's the same state, it's the same circular string, but described at weak coupling. So what could be our circular string? Well, it's from what I told you, it should be the single cut solution. Let's try that. The simplest cut, the one that has only one cut. Okay? So there's only one cut. That would be the simplest possible classical solution. Now, so that means that we have to solve the equations. Those equations there, we tell that L over UJ minus 2, sum over K not equal to J up to N, 1 over UJ minus UK? UJ minus UK is equal to 2 pi N for any J. You see, we choose the same integer for all j's. So we dropped, the only thing I did is I dropped the index j from the mode number. I said everyone has the same mode number. There's just one mode. Okay? Very good. How do you propose to solve this equation? Can hang, are you okay? You want a glass? Maybe it's better to get can hang a glass of water. Okay? Well, okay. How do you propose to solve this equation?
Multiplying by the sum.
Sorry?
Like we did for the matrix model.
Like we did for the matrix model. We had exactly the same equation, remember? Well, maybe I can write here. For the matrix model, we add, what was it? It was something like some constant, I don't remember, I think it was this. Uj plus 1 over g squared, sum of k not equal to j up to n, 1 over uj minus uk equal to 0. It was really very similar, right? So what did we do? We define a resolvent z, g of z, which is defined to be a sum over 1 over z minus uj. Right? Remember, this resolvent contains all the information about the position of all the roots. Do you agree? Yeah? And then what's the next step? Let's really mimic what we did for the matrix model. And now? What do we do? You can go to your notes. Sorry? Okay, Ivan is proposing we square it. Let me just remind you. I will not finish. Yeah, we just square. Then what do we do when we square? We get two terms, 1 over z minus uj squared for the diagonal ones. And then there is another one, sum over g not equal to k, the other ones. Then we do a part and we replace this by 2 over z minus uj times uj minus uk. Right? Then the sum over k not equal to j of this guy, we use Bittanzat's equation and so on. And we find an equation for g. Okay? And it closes into an equation. And at the end of the day, we have a quadratic equation for g of z. For that, it's very important that this n doesn't depend on j. If it did, nothing would work. For the case where you have different numbers, more powerful techniques are needed, and they are available, but that would go beyond the scope of today's lecture. You solve that equation, and this is what you get. So g, which remember was the sum from j equal 1 up to n, 1 over z minus uj, when you solve this quadratic equation, you get 1 over 2z times l minus 2 pi. Sorry. Let me call this small number m, for reasons that will become clear later. 2 pi m z plus the square root 2 pi m z minus l square plus 8 pi m z. Okay? So you see that if n is small, if you don't have that many particles, if n is small, z and l are both of order l, then the zeros of the square root are given by z equal l over 2 pi m. Okay? They are exactly at the middle of this cut. This would be the point, roughly, this point, some point roughly here, would be l over 2 pi m. And then, because you have n, the zeros are actually a bit spread out, and these are the zeros of the square root. Okay. Remember why? Because you remember that the discontinuity of this resolvent is the density. So the density goes to 0 at the end of the contour. So it's the point where the square root goes to 0. Okay? So now there is some density along that contour and goes to 0 at the end. So this is perfectly consistent. Now that we have the resolvent, let's use it to compute two interesting quantities, the total momenta and the energy. Of this state. So how do you propose to compute a total momenta? So let's remind ourselves, what is the total momenta? The total momenta P, okay, is just sum from j equal 1 up to n, 1 over I log of uj plus I over 2 over uj minus I over 2. This was the momenta. Remember that we expanded already. So this is just a sum from j equal 1 up to n of 1 over uj. So how do I get this sum if I know the resolvent?
Integrating with the density?
That's one possibility, but that's very complicated. There's a much simpler way.
Is that zero?
Sorry? Zero. Yeah, just put z equal to 0, and that's exactly that sum. So this is nothing but minus the resolvent at 0. Okay? And if you do it, you get, from this computation, you get minus pi m. So what do we learn? Remember. But now remember that we need to impose cyclicity. So is this good, that the moment is pi times m? We needed something better. So what do you propose? We would like 2m, yeah, but we got m. So what do you propose?
Is it plus or minus?
Sorry?
Is it plus pi m or minus pi?
Yes, probably plus. Depends on the choice of the square root. Yeah. You must be careful because there is a square root. So if you choose some branch at infinity, when you go up to zero, you need to get an extra minus sign. I think I did it carefully. It should be okay. So as we said, it is not this, but this needs to belong to 2 pi z. This is the condition of cyclicity. So what does it tell us about M? M is even. So it just tells us that M is an even number. Okay, what about the energy? The energy is given by lambda over 8 pi square, sum from j equal 1 up to n, 1 over uj square plus 1 quarter. But when n is large, the 1 quarter is irrelevant, so this is just lambda over 8 pi square, sum over 1 over uj square. How do I get this one from the resolvent?
Take the derivative.
Take the derivative at zero. If I take a derivative, I get square, then I put zero, and I get that. So this is just lambda over 8 pi square, derivative at the resolvent at zero. Okay? And if we compute, so the energy that, remember, is the anomalous dimension. So if we compute this, then we conclude that delta, which is the energy, is equal to L J, let me say J is equal to L. So it's equal to J plus this correction that we computed here, which will be n squared lambda over 2j. Okay? This is what we will get. Now, and you see, so this is the classical energy. This is the classical. So this is delta naught. For x to the n. Here I did something else already. Remember that we want to compare with a circular string there. But for the circular string, n, so let's put L here, and this is 4. I'm trying to already approach the circular string. I'm already replacing n by j over 2 and L by j, just to make contact with the notation that we used for the string. Then in that case, you see there is no n disappears because it is just j over 2 and L, so you get just this simple result. Otherwise, you get something slightly more complicated but still simple. Okay. I can write in general, you get the following. Delta is equal to L plus lambda, if I did no mistake, it's the following, n squared L minus m over 2 L cubed. But for this particular case, you get this expansion here. Okay? Now, this is three-level. This is what you would call three-level. This is what you would call one loop. And then there are corrections. Then there are terms of order lambda squared that we did not compute. What would we do to compute the terms of order n squared? Well, we would have to study our Hamiltonian one loop further, correct the bit equations, and then repeat everything again. Or do perturbation theory, just correct this resolvent and then correct it. Yes?
Is big M the same as big N?
Yes, sorry. Sorry about that. So, tomorrow I will tell you more about higher loops, but today let me just tell you what you would get if you would compute one more loop. If you would compute one more loop, you would get minus lambda square n to the 4 over 8 j cube plus dot dot dot. So this would be a two loop computation. Okay? So this is what we get. Any question here? So this is the energy of this classical operator that depends on this J that we claim is the dual of this circular string. And this is what we get. We get J plus a small correction plus dot dot dot.
Question?
Yes?
Is this just a coincidence that it looks like the next term is just a half of the second term squared? Would we expect the three loop calculation to give the same thing that 1 over 3 factorial, for example?
Okay, can you make a guess for the next one? So Andrew wants to make a guess.
Yeah, but... So
what's your guess here? Can you tell me?
N to the 6th lambda cubed over 2 cubed times 6 3 factorial. So 6 times 2 cubed.
Now how much is that?
6 times
48?
Yeah.
48? And what power do you want here?
J squared, J cubed, J to the 4th.
Five.
Or 5.
Yeah. 5, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let me tell you, let's see in a moment. Now!
That 48 comes from.
Sorry?
I don't think it's 48. It's,
so it's not 48? That tells me what
two,
it is.
2 cubed.
It's 48?
Yeah, I think so. It's 1 over 3
factorial. Okay, very good. Should I call it a theorem or a guess? So,
conjecture,
very good. So now, let's go and stare at the same result that we found when lambda was very large. So that is the result that we have at weak coupling, the first three terms. And then we have a guess. And this, on the other hand, is what we have at a strong couple. But now let's do a following trick. And this is called, can I write here? Yes? Let's do the so-called Frolov-Zeitlin trick. And the Frolov-Zeitlin trick is to say the following. Okay, so lambda is very large, because we are doing classical strings. Okay. J is also very large, by the same reason. They are classical. Okay? But let's do a trick. We are studying quantities where J is very large. It's of order lambda. Lambda is also very large. But let's take lambda over J squared to be small. Okay? The two are very large, but let's take J to be even bigger than lambda, to be very, very large. Then, what does that become? Delta becomes equal to, you take out J, and you write J times square root 1 plus lambda n square over J square. And now this quantity I said is very small, so you just expand. You get J plus lambda n square over 2 J square minus lambda square n 4 over 8 J to the J cube, J 5. And what's the next one? Is it yours? And now you might have noticed that what you get is exactly the weak coupling result for the first two. And the next one, according to what I wrote, it's 16. So your conjecture was lambda cube and 6. But actually, it doesn't invalidate your conjecture, as I will now explain. Over 16. I did some mistake. Yeah, this was J. This was J cube. And this is J 5. So if I didn't do any mistake expanding the square root, this is what you get. You might want to check in Mathematica if this is the expansion of the square root. I think it is, no? Sorry?
It doesn't look like 16.
It's not 16? What is it?
I think it's correct.
How much?
I think the 16 is correct.
16 is correct? Good. So, so the remarkable thing is that even though lambda is large, it looks like a weak coupling expansion. Even though lambda was large, lambda started, it was a large number. Lambda was large, j was large. But by doing this trick of expanding in lambda over j squared and saying that j is even bigger and lambda over j squared is small, just from a strong coupling result, I generated something that looks like a weak coupling expansion. It's just a way of writing the strong coupling in a way that looks like weak coupling. And indeed, you compare with weak coupling, and after all this work, we see that the first three coefficients match perfectly. Okay? The first three match perfectly. But this one fails. So I don't know what is the real one, so maybe your guess is still correct. But it fails. Now, there's no mystery here. What would be a mystery would be if it worked. We don't have the right. When you have a function of two variables, you don't have the right to do this. This is illegal. This is not correct mathematics. This is not, there is order of limits ambiguities in this. You don't have the right when you have a function of lambda and j. You don't have the right to suppose that expanding first in lambda and then in j is the same as expanding at large lambda and then taking lambda over j squared to be large. So we did two different things. There, first we expanded in large lambda, we got some result, and then we re-expanded it, assuming that j is even bigger than lambda. And that's fine, this is correct. I mean, this is a correct result. It's true, this square root is equal to this. There's nothing illegal here. But if I would take the original result given from the sky, and I take the delta, and I first expand in lambda, that's not what I get. I get that instead. This is the... So both expansions are okay. You see, delta is equal to this, and delta is equal to that, and the dot dot dots don't agree, but that's fine. It's because when I'm writing that and that, I'm doing different expansions. But the remarkable thing is that the first ones do agree. And there is actually a general proof that for all classical string solutions, there is a precise identification of one-to-one of which solution here matches to which solution here. And for all of them, there is this so-called Fallot-Seitlin limit if you put lots of angular momentum in the sphere, and there will be a match for all the n.
But in the circular string, does n has to be even?
N there is an integer. N here now is an integer. M has to be integer. Okay? That's why I wanted to keep the letter n for later. M is not an integer. M is an even number. N is our integer. So let me conclude. So what do I want to say? So even though now a more modern point of view, for a very long time this even had a name. This was called the three-loop mismatch. Because you have three loops, there is not a match. But then, okay, people realized, okay, I mean, we were asking for too much. It was luck that it worked in the first place. But still, this luck is highly inspiring because now you can go and study other quantities. Say, three-point functions instead of energies, instead of the spectrum. And you can try to repeat the same tricks. Do computations at weak coupling, strong coupling. Take this funny Fallot-Seitlin limit and see if both match. So again, if they don't match, like they don't match at some loop order, doesn't mean you failed, doesn't mean you have a mistake. But given that we know that for the spectrum there is this very nice luck, we can imagine that for other quantities, probably we will have the same luck. And if we do, then we believe, okay, probably we are on the right track. And much of the activity of the recent days or weeks related to the advances of three-point functions are exactly trying to explore this Fallot-Seitlin limit to see if weak and strong coupling results are also matching and giving the same thing. And right now, people check the first two orders, and again, there seems to be a match. So this is an important hint. It's again the SCFT working as an inspiration. So if you do this two-loop computation, for another solution, you know that in principle it should match, and if it does match, then you are confident about your two-loop computation. Okay, so let me just mention that you see that we understand that classical solutions of bit equations at weak coupling are described by some surface with a bunch of cuts. Okay? A surface with a bunch of cuts. You can imagine that surface with a bunch of cuts, the cuts are discontinuity, so you can imagine that this defines the Riemann surface with two sheets. And the cuts unite the two sheets. So you have a Riemann surface, a two-sheeted Riemann surface, with cuts uniting the two sheets. So you have a map from classical solutions to bit equation to Riemann surfaces of a given genus. For example, if you have three cuts, it will be genus 2. Four cuts, genus 3, and so on. So there is a map. In the classical limit, there exists a map from solutions to bit ansatz for our particles with momenta pj and so on. From the quantization, there is a map to Riemann surfaces of a given genus. And on the other hand, at strong coupling, there is a way of mapping each classical solution. There exists a map here of each classical motion of the string There is a map into each classical motion of the string, again, into a Riemann surface that encodes all charges of the solution. I'm not explaining, you should just take it for a fact. I'm just telling you what is the most general formalism where we understand the particular case that we saw today in full generality. And it is in this formalism, which is the formalism of classical integrable models, where you understand that there is a way of mapping each classical solution to a given Riemann surface. You can even do more. You can forget about partial differential equations that you need to solve the string equations of motion and just open your algebraic geometry book and look for a catalog of Riemann surfaces. So understanding the moduli space of Riemann surface is exactly in one-to-one to understanding classical solutions of the string. Similarly, here, you can also ignore bit equations and just parameterize the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, and they parameterize classical solutions of bit equations. And then, it's in this language that you identify which state corresponds to which. A state with three, genus 3, and some cycles of that Riemann surface should correspond to a state with genus 3 and the same cycles on that Riemann surface. And it's in this language, this is a common language, that allows in full generality to understand the connection of the states between weak and strong coupling in the classical limit. Tomorrow, we will move to what we will call what are the most recent developments in the field of correlation functions. So I will tell you, so tomorrow it will be a lecture again where probably we will not have many derivations, but I will probably just state main results and important research directions that people have been following over the past weeks or months. If you agree, if you prefer me to cover in more detail any of the points that we have discussed, or if there's something in particular you want to hear, I can also do that. I just thought for the last lecture it might be good to give you a global picture of what next. But it's really up to you. Are there questions about today? Apart from this last Riemann surface part, which I know it is just motivational, is the rest clear? Yeah? Very good. See you tomorrow then.